So good morning, everyone. Welcome to How to Become the Social Entrepreneur or Entrepreneurs of Your Life, Doing Well by Doing Good. My name is Carter Quigg. I'm the store team leader of Whole Foods Market here in Philadelphia, and I'll be your host for this session. Whole Foods Market is proud to be part of the Pennsylvania Conference of Women. Not only is Whole Foods Market invested in the growth of women in their professional careers, but we are also deeply invested in conscious capitalism, looking for ways to align our efforts with creating social good from our Whole Planet Foundation to regular team member volunteerism. We strive to do well by doing good. Today we're going to be digging in on how you can use some practical advice and inspiration to make your mark, leveraging your own professional endeavors to have a greater social impact. Beyond that, looking at how to invest in girls to become advocates and change makers in their communities globally, and also becoming smarter shoppers by supporting organizations that give back as part of their core mission. Our thought leader today is Kenya Haupt. She is the National People Director in Corporate Responsibility for PricewaterhouseCoopers. She's residing in Denver, Colorado. Her responsibilities entail engaging U.S. employees in various corporate social responsibility initiatives, such as volunteerism, serving on boards of directors, participating in green teams, and other socially and environmentally responsible practices. One of her premier projects sent 400 people to Belize City during 2 weeks in July to teach financial acumen to children teachers and administrators in Belize. Haupt has been with her firm for over 28 years, and she is here today to help us dig into the subject again of doing well by doing good. Without further ado, please welcome up Kenya Haupt.
Thank you, Carter. So, you know, you guys, I'm from Denver. We don't have conferences this big. I'm from just a little kind of a little cow town, and I've been to many, many conferences in my career. When I walked through those doors this morning, I thought, holy cow, they do not mess around. They do not mess around, 7,000 women, and how fun it is to look out there and see all of you here. So I'm really excited about this session. I think, first of all, I'm humbled and honored and inspired to be a part of the panel with these three very, very inspirational ladies. I mean, when I read their bios to you and give you a little bit of story on them, I think you too will be highly, highly impressed. So just as the particular session is all about, we are going to learn a little bit about social entrepreneurship and how some of the things that they will share with you this morning you can actually apply. So let's start. I'm going to introduce the panelists, and I'm going to start with Samantha. Samantha's over there on my far right, your far left. Samantha is Vice President of Impact Strategy for Girl Rising, and she's passionate about the power of storytelling to create global change. In her role, she has launched and runs the Girl Rising Innovation Lab, which is an initiative that develops pilots that test how film can be optimally harnessed for good. And pilots that work are scaled up then into global campaigns, and those campaigns have reached over 150 countries worldwide. A relatively new transplant to New York City, Samantha was previously based in China as managing director of TEDx Beijing, and before this she has worked as an analyst with the UN World Food Program in Laos, targeting emergency food assistance. Other projects have included crafting narratives for a 12-part history documentary, grassroots human rights advocacy in East Africa, and developing inner-city literacy programs in Canada. She's graduated as a National Millennium Scholar and the University Gold Medalist. She earned an MPhil in International Relations from the University of Oxford. So welcome, Samantha. All right. Now let me introduce to you Ritu Sharma. Ritu is co-founder and president of Women Thrive Worldwide and a leading voice on women's issues in U.S. foreign policy. For 20 years, she has navigated Washington's politics and built the leading nonprofit organization that amplifies the voices of women and girls in developing countries with decision makers in the U.S. and at the global level. She's an author of the acclaimed book, Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the World. I believe there's a book signing later. Okay. This book has been called a true must-read by President Jimmy Carter. And Teach a Woman to Fish really shows how women are triumphing over the forces that threaten to keep them in poverty and how those in the United States and elsewhere can help. So welcome, Ritu. And our third panelist today is Yvette Nunez. She's the Chief Communications Officer at Congreso de Latinos Unidos, one of the largest Latino nonprofits in the nation, according to Hispanic Business Magazine, and the largest in the Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware tri-state area. In this capacity, Yvette is responsible for oversight of the agency's communications, fundraising, civic engagement, and corporate relations. And prior to joining Congreso, she worked as a media specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau's 2010 census in the Philadelphia region, managing mainstream social and Latino media. She's got an extensive history serving as a volunteer dedicated to her passions, which are communications and the Latino community. Yvette was the first person of color to preside over the Philadelphia Public Relations Association, the nation's oldest public relations membership association. She served on numerous committees. She has chaired numerous different conferences, and she's been recognized as one of Delaware Valley's 10 most influential Latinos under 40. So welcome to Yvette. So again, I don't know about you, but I'm just humbled to be in front of these lovely ladies to my right here. So part of what we're here for today is to really learn how we can sort of leverage our skills. So I want to ask a question to each of you, and really just wanted to know a little bit more about how you actually did leverage the skills that you've built to really make a difference in the nonprofit world.
So I'll start. I think what's been really important for me over the course of my career is to merge my talents or skills and my passions. And they're not always the same, right? I know people who are very passionate about dancing salsa, but not necessarily very talented at it. So I know that I've been very passionate about serving my community, serving the Latino community, serving low-income communities. And I know that my talents have been writing, storytelling, and working within the nonprofit sector has really allowed me the opportunity to merge those two. I believe that over the course of our careers, if you're not clear on what those are now, if you're not clear on what your talent is or what your passions are, it becomes crystallized through the more experiences that you show up for, whether at work or whether through volunteer opportunities.
And Yvette, thank you very much for that. I appreciate that. I love the salsa dancing comment.
Yeah, that would be me. Love it. Can't do it. Can I ask, how many of you are with private for-profit firms? If you just raise your hands. And how many of you are with not-for-profit firms? And how many of you are still trying to figure out which way you want to go? Okay, so it's almost half and half. That's great. Excellent. In terms of skills, I would really agree with Yvette first on knowing both, really understanding what your skill set is and what you are really good at, and then what it is that you love to do. Before I started the organization Women Thrive Worldwide, which is 17 years ago, I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out what I actually loved doing, not just in terms of a topic, you know, sort of international women's rights issues, but really in terms of the day-to-day activities on a job. You know, what did I like? Did I really enjoy writing or did I actually hate it? And did I like public speaking or was that going to be something that would scare me to death? It obviously isn't. I'm here talking to you today, so that one worked out. But that the time that I spent doing that was really, I think, valuable and helping then figure out what the next step would be and ultimately in creating an organization. So you know, just to kick off, one thing I think that you can do is there's so many books out there on this topic, from What Color Is Your Parachute or Live the Life You Love, and so many, but to take some time to really figure out those two things. What is it that you're passionate about, and what are the things that you actually love to do on a day-to-day basis? Because whichever direction you go, for-profit, non-profit, you all know that a job really comes down to what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Well, both of... Is it working?
Yes.
Okay. It's funny. I was like, I'm going to say this, and then Yvette says it. And I was like, and then I'm going to say this, and then Richie says it. So I'm like, what am I going to say? So suffice to say, I agree entirely with what they both said. And what I might add to it is that I think we hear a lot that we should follow our dreams and follow our passions and be passionate. But sometimes it's hard to figure those out, or what are my skills and how can I apply those? And that can be hard to figure out, too. And I would just encourage... as the core of discovery of those things, a deep curiosity. Because what I actually think is most valuable is not just learning what you like, but learning what you really don't like. You know, I thought, maybe I want to work at the UN. Like, that sounds great. When I tell people at dinner parties, they're really impressed, right? You know, where do you do? Oh, I work at the UN. Like, cool, right? And then I realized when I got there, as amazing as the work was, that working in a big, big organization just wasn't for me. I have a real deep sense of impatience and a healthy deference for authority. So the thought of working in a big bureaucracy just like was not a great pairing. And that was important for me, and important to have the courage to leave what I thought was my life's dream and to pursue something else. So what I'd say is that I agree entirely that you need to figure it out and you need to explore, but you also, I think, need to be aware when what you're doing isn't working, and be brave and find the courage to try something else.
And I love what each of you have said. And it's funny, Samantha, Yvette and I were just talking prior to coming over here, and I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said you really need to be aware of what it is you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a key thing, and I don't think a lot of us always sit down and think about what is it I don't want to do. We probably spend a fair amount of time thinking about what we do want to do, but just sort of trying to stay away from the don'ts. And I think there are so many influential people in our lives, too, that they have an idea of what they want us to do. And we have to sometimes just kind of block those things out and really focus on what's important to us, and that's typically where we will succeed. So thank you, ladies. I think that's great. Let me ask another question, sort of all three of you, and then we'll start to get into a few more conversations, sort of one-on-one. You know, there are numerous nonprofits out there. There's not a shortage of nonprofits. As women, how can we really kind of align ourselves? Or how would you recommend, I guess, we go about thinking through those choices? And how can we really align ourselves with the nonprofits that really do make a difference to us? Ritu, do you mind starting?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to start on that question. I just want to underline what Kenya said. There are so many nonprofits out there, and I'm often asked the question in these sort of social entrepreneurship sessions about, well, how do I start my own nonprofit? That's great. That's the first thing you need to do is really understand the field of that nonprofit organization. If you're coming at a nonprofit kind of issue from outside of that space, I would really advise you to spend a couple of years getting to know that space. And chances are, for better or worse, there are already three or four nonprofits doing exactly that thing that you want to do. So as an entrepreneur, your task is really to figure out, do you want to join one of those nonprofits? Are they doing the work in a way that aligns with your values, your skills? And can you find a position working there, or do you want to volunteer? Or do you actually still want to start your own nonprofit? And for those of you who are small business owners, running a nonprofit is just the same as running a small business. It is not less work. It is no less easy than running your own business. So I wouldn't look at that as kind of an ideal change to a slower pace of life. So
when you think about that, you know, it's the same in many ways of looking at your at a for-profit work. You have to know your niche. What are you selling? What is your product? Who's going to really buy it? Who's going to make donations to you to do that nonprofit mission? If you don't want to work for the four other organizations that are doing it, what will differentiate your organization? What will make it better or worth more funding as opposed to the other ones that already exist? So you can also approach it very much like starting a small business. You know, have a business plan, be very clear about what your goals are, keep it specific, keep it small at first, and then you have to sort of take that leap of faith and give it a try and see what happens.
Samantha?
My feeling about trying to find what cause or what nonprofit to start with, my bias is to start locally. The reason I say that is because, first of all, the return on your investment of time is usually way greater. So, again, it can feel sexy to be like, I'm working with this huge global organization that does all this amazing work around the world. And what you usually end up doing is something pretty small, something like selling cookies at a festival, which is great, and that's important, and the money that you can raise is awesome. But I find that folks who start working locally, whether it's Boys and Girls Club or whether it's a, you know, an education initiative or a women's mentorship program or whatever it is, the returns that they feel so good every day, they like wake up giggling kind of thing, that feeling is infectious and will inspire them to continue exploring. So that's the first thing I'd say, like start locally. And then two, I echo Ritu's advice around the importance of not always wanting to start your own thing, but I do think starting your own thing can be great, and I think in that process of the aspiration to start, I think the key is finding a real need that you can get behind. And so again, I would encourage you to start locally and really explore your public service in a way that feels exciting. You may be like, oh my gosh, like they're awful at marketing. I can really help out. Or like there is a need in this space for like strong, I don't know, Caribbean women leaders, and these Caribbean origin young girls need to see these stories. And you find like the niches become really, and the gaps become really obvious when you're in the thick of it. But it's important to be able to be in the thick of it. And I find sometimes when you start volunteering for a big organization, you don't get access to see the niches. So that's where I would start.
I'm going to answer that two different ways. One is, unfortunately, it's not really that hard to start a nonprofit. There's not enough regulation around who runs a nonprofit, who can file paperwork for a nonprofit. So do your homework when it comes to which nonprofit you're going to choose to invest your very valuable time with. There are options like GuideStar, Charity Navigator, where you can make sure that this nonprofit is fiscally responsible and is doing good things and is really pursuing its mission in an ethical way. The other way I'm going to answer that is wearing my PR hat and see what people on the ground are saying about the nonprofits that you're thinking about aligning with. What are their clients saying? Who is it that they're serving? And what are those folks saying about the quality of service that they're getting and the impact that they're having really on the lives of people? What are the staff saying? What are people in the street saying? Hey, have you ever heard of this nonprofit? And the more that you're able to get those kinds of stories, the better you can judge whether or not it's something that you want to be a part of. There are many, many nonprofits, as I shared, and you can definitely find something that's very well aligned with your personality, with your talents, with your passion. So just do your homework, both researching the nonprofit's responsibility and then researching by just having conversations with people that the nonprofit has touched.
And such great advice. I mean, so many great points that just came out of that. You know, some things that we do at PricewaterhouseCoopers are we really encourage our people to join boards of directors. And that's a really great way to just sort of get kicked off and kind of think about, you know, what's the nonprofit really working toward? What's their success? And one of the things that we always remind people before they join a board of directors is really do your homework, which is what these ladies have said, you know, for a number of reasons. And it can even be things simple as, what's the size of the board? How many of you out there sit on a board of directors? which is phenomenal, because I could take the whole angle around the skills development that increases, and the networking exposures that you get from sitting on a board. But if you think about the size of the board of directors that you might be considering joining, that too can sort of speak to Samantha's point about the churn on time. I joined a board of directors many, many years ago in Rhodes, and it was a large board, so I don't feel like we put in as many hours necessarily as other boards that I have been a part of. I currently sit on a board called Foundation for Global Scholars, and their staff is only two people. So the organization relies heavily on the board members to actually get work done. So it's just another thing that you might want to think about, too, in terms of your time as you're considering these kinds of things. So thank you again, ladies. So let me ask, Yvette, let me ask you this question. We'll start here. How have you sort of made, and when we were introducing you, we talked about your dual passion around sort of serving the Latino community and communications. So how have you really made a career out of pursuing that dual passion?
Mm-hmm. So in the nonprofit sector, I haven't necessarily always worked within the Latino community. But when I haven't, I've identified opportunities, whether through committees, task forces, or boards of directors, where I could keep my foot in that door and where I could find some personal satisfaction around serving the Latino community while doing communications by day. And the truth is that there are so many nonprofits who are desperate for volunteers and who are desperate for skilled volunteers, meaning, yes, you can volunteer by collecting tickets at an event, but if you're an accountant or you're in PR or you're really great with HR, there are so many nonprofits that could really use your expertise. During the times that I have worked within Latino organizations, and I do so today, I still find that I have a need to find a different way to serve. So by day, I'm a chief communications officer. That's an executive position. Most of my day is definitely spent promoting the organization, developing strategic plans, and all of that certainly helps the organization and therefore its community be strengthened. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm not usually interacting with clients or community residents. So even though I'm working for a Latino organization doing communications, and it would seem like the very best of both worlds, job done, I still find that I have the need to go and interact and engage with our community and our clients. So my very favorite days are when I get to visit a program and get to sit with high school students who are doing amazing things, or with our older adult volunteer group, women who are over the age of 60, have survived domestic violence, on paper are living in poverty, but when you meet these women, the last thing you think about is poverty, because they have so much to offer in terms of life experience, their just personal sense of happiness. So they're will always be, I think, a tug for me to find, and knowing that I'm not a social worker, there'll always be a tug for me to find ways to tell their stories. So, my writing and my communication skills not necessarily being applied via my day job, but finding a way to apply it as a volunteer and on behalf of those women and those community residents.
Great, thank you very much, Yvette. Just and staying with that for a minute, just around communications, and you've been doing this for a number of years. I mean, how have you had to modify, your communication style or what you're doing from a communications perspective to sort of fit the new millennial generation?
Oh yeah, when I'm not that old, but I remember when email was relatively a new thing. Well, I remember when email was a new thing. But I remember people saying, oh, my God, she's like the email queen. So it started with email. And then blogs and social media. In the work that I've done as a community volunteer, I think one of the biggest barriers is just access to information. And how easy is it to get information? But when you don't have that information, let's say you want to apply to something and you don't know when the deadline is, you miss the deadline, you're out of it. There are so many people in our community, in the Latino community, not just the Latino community, but underserved communities who don't have access to information. Think about all the people that you interact with on a day-to-day basis and how much information is shared. Oh, did you hear about this? Did you hear about that? That's not necessarily happening in the same way in communities, in underserved communities, low-income communities, the unemployed population. The conversations aren't happening the same way, so they don't have that information. So I'm very passionate about, at minimum, making sure that communities in need have access to these kinds of resources, to what nonprofits have services for their kids, for employment, to further their education, and have benefited, I think, in this era where we have so many different ways to communicate that.
Thank you. Thank you. And you mentioned storytelling, Yvette, so I'm going to pitch this one then to Samantha. You're all about storytelling, so tell me why that's an important tool for change.
I'll give a quick anecdote, which is that I like we were talking about earlier in terms of finding what you want to do, I tried a bunch of things, like lots of shoes on for fit and size. So I was like, maybe I'll do, you heard my bio, maybe I'll try human rights advocacy in East Africa, or maybe I'll try food security, maybe I'll try, this or that. And I tried all these things, and it was amazing having that exposure. And the thing that I learned time and time and time again was that almost every issue, we know the answer. Like, that's not the problem. Like, we know, like, if you want to, if you want to improve agricultural yields, do this, this, and this. Or we want to combat climate change, we probably just need to pollute less. Like, it's not rocket science, the answers. But it's how to get people to do the hard thing, the right thing, when it's also the hard thing that's really tough. Getting that emotional motivation. And I saw that in every issue I tried. And so what it gave me, with a deep hunger to do something meaningful, is a conviction that what I didn't need to do was try to unearth the great truth of the world, because it was unearthed already. But what I did need to learn about and figure out is how we could inspire people to change their behavior and do the right thing when it's the hard thing. And nothing is more powerful as a tool than a story that resonates deep within you. And you see, and I've seen, in my privilege working with Girl Rising and seeing our film showcased in every possible context you can imagine, how it transforms people in life-changing ways when they feel something inside that reminds them about a way that they wanted to feel, or a feeling they've had before, or helps them imagine a new future or see a new sense of possibility. And so I became obsessed, and I can share later on, how I discovered this, my own interest in it and passion for it, but that's really the framing. And so the why storytelling, why can that change the world? Well, if we can start by finding and sharing more stories, that's powerful. I had the privilege of working on a panel with Samantha Power last Thursday, and she's the U.S. ambassador to the UN and an epic woman in the world. And she stood up, and I will always remember what she said. She says, world leaders, they're people too. And she says, and you're really? And then at the UN, she says, if you look over to your right and you look over to your left, you see them doodling, and you see them checking their Twitter, and you see them tuning out. And they might be talking about, nuclear proliferation, might be talking about Ebola, really important stuff, but you can only hold so much in your head. They're just human beings. But when she shared this, I think our own experiences will confirm this, when, for example, recently there was an amazing young woman who is a refugee from the DRC who now studies in upstate New York. And she has suffered all sorts of atrocious things, violence. Her family was murdered. It's crazy. And she stood up and spoke quietly and softly, but with conviction and heart, to a room of world leaders. And not a single person wasn't listening. And after she spoke, not a single person didn't want to do something. And so I could just go on and on all day. I love storytelling. I think it's so important, and I think we can all do it, and we can all use it. And I feel like one of our great opportunities to try to do it more and more.
And you're so right, Samantha. We can all connect with a personal story. And while I think we all like to have facts and figures because sometimes that sort of underscores things for us, I really do believe that it's those stories that we can connect with from the heart. How many of you have actually seen the Girl Rising film? How many of you actually know what Girl Rising is about? Okay, a good amount. Samantha, do you mind just literally taking maybe 30 seconds and giving a quick download about the film?
I'm like, should I talk really quickly or say less?
How about a combination of the two?
30 seconds, gosh. Well, the quick summary is that Girl Rising is a global campaign for girls' education, and we use storytelling and high-quality media to share the message that educating girls isn't just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing. And let me see if I can do it in 15 seconds. The origin of the film came out from a team of documentary makers who unearthed a powerful truth, which is that, and I'm sure Riti's book echoes this over and over again, if you educate a girl, you can improve health outcomes, you can improve agricultural yields, you can do all sorts of amazing things, you can change the world. And so Girl Rising, when we discovered this unbelievably important truth, we realized we had a project to do, and so we put together a feature film featuring 9 girls in 9 countries with 9 writers bringing their stories to life and 9 actresses like Meryl Streep and Anne Hathaway and Selena Gomez and other amazing superstars. And we launched a film with our breath bated, hoping it would work, and you know, a year and a half since we released, it's now been shown in over 150 countries, over 1 billion impressions, thousands of people worldwide motivated to take action in their communities, and we're just poised to launch in India, Nigeria, and the Congo next year. So it's been an unbelievable adventure.
Thank you. And it's a pretty compelling film. PwC actually just purchased a license to actually show the film across the U.S., and we've actually got a show scheduled in London as well coming up and then on some university campuses. But my colleagues down here in the front were one of the first ones to actually show the film here in Philadelphia. So hats off to you, because it is pretty inspiring. If you get an opportunity to even view the trailer, I promise it will invite you to want to watch the entire film. So Ritu, let's switch to you for just a second. Can you talk about a few things the corporate executives or some of the folks here in the office might want to think about as they're sort of serving nonprofits or transitioning into that arena?
Yeah, sure. One of the other things I want to mention in addition to that is I think in the description for this session it talked about Tom's, the shoe company that, you know, made the shoes that a lot of folks are wearing, and for every pair they give a pair overseas. And in terms of that kind of entrepreneurship, sort of an organization that makes something or provides a service that also does good, I think, again, it's many of the same principles. You know, what is the product? What is the market niche? And there's, in my mind, 2 ways of doing that. You can sell something and then take the profits and give benefits to it to a service or something that people need, or the very thing that you're making or doing is in itself a service. But again, the same principles apply to starting a small business or starting any other kind of venture. So, you know, I wouldn't look at social entrepreneurship as something that is so different than what you already do in your businesses. It's just finding something else to apply those skills to. And in terms of, you know, what people in the corporate world might consider or think about as you seek to engage with nonprofits, one is that there is a different culture, as you all can imagine, and in some ways a different set of skills or values or things that are valued in the workplace or in the culture of a nonprofit organization versus a for-profit organization. And one thing is to keep in mind those differences. At Women Thrive, we've had a number of people who come out of corporate America who want to work with this or want to help us.
But there's sort of the cultural fit. You know, we're not an organization that's going to turn into a corporation, and it wouldn't work for our business model anyway. So one thing is to kind of keep in mind those differences and how much you personally can tolerate those differences. If that's something that's really important to you, that sort of nonprofits work like businesses, they should be efficient, they should be goal-driven, they should be results-oriented. But you want to kind of have a different gestalt when you go into a not-for-profit. The other one is to really understand that you're volunteering for a nonprofit, whether it's the board or a technical skill that you're offering, actually requires quite a bit of time and effort on behalf of the nonprofit organization to make it really valuable for both parties. The best projects that we have done were long-term partnerships with, you know, marketing or branding experts where the organization invested tens of thousands of dollars of staff time to do the work with the expert to come out with an excellent product that we could use and that the volunteer found really deeply satisfying. So when you think about, you know, those are two things I think very important to keep in mind, some of the cultural differences that you'll encounter, and also just understanding and valuing how much time that it takes on behalf of the nonprofit to really utilize your skills and what you have to offer to the best end.
And that's such an important point, I think, me too. And I think it's probably something, I mean, even just listening to you talk about it, and the organizations that I've personally been involved with, whether it was volunteering or boards, I think you're right. It's something that we probably just take for granted. I mean, even just like the prep time that it takes to prepare for a board meeting, which you probably all know, that's not a light lift. So I appreciate your sharing those comments. That's great. So let me just shift a little bit to sort of women and girls and ask each of you kind of why you're doing what it is you're doing. I mean, we've talked a little bit about this. But, you know, I was reading, it was a gender article actually in Forbes last week, and they were talking about the one of the things that they were talking about was the percentage of philanthropic dollars that actually go to women and girls issues. I'm just going to toss it out there. What do you all think that percentage is? How much philanthropic dollars in total do you think are targeted towards women and girls issues? I'm very deaf.
I hear 7, 10, 7, 10. 12.
Well, you're close. It is 7%. 7%. Which to me, I guess as I read that, seems staggeringly low. Very low. And we can all make a change in that specific area. But I'm going to start, I guess, Samantha, with you. You know, Girl Rising. Why girls?
Why? It's interesting. The film's genesis wasn't started by people who were especially passionate about girls and women's issues. Of course, we think girls should be educated. That's great. Of course. But it wasn't a passion project from the beginning. I think, as I said earlier, why girls was because we realized it was so smart. And it's not just for girls. Like, it's good that girls are educated. It's for everybody. Because when girls are educated, we know everybody wins. And we knew if we were going to pick an issue to focus on, girls' education would be it, because the return on investment in educating girls means they marry later, they have less children, that their kids are educated, that they're healthier, and a cycle emerges that only can have, that only has positive effects in their communities. And so the smartest intervention, not just the most morally righteous one, was girls' education, and that's the core raison d'etre for Girl Rising.
Yep. And Ritu, so you've written this book, you know, Teach a Woman to Fish. First of all, anybody out there ever want to write a book? I think that's a cool goal to have. I would like to write a book, so I'm interested to hear how did you even get started?
Well, I had wanted to write this book for a long time, for about 6 years, and the best way to write a book is to make sure you have a contract so that you have to finish the book, right? Because otherwise it really might not get done. But for those of you who hope to do it, I hope you will. You know, why women and girls? I think what Samantha has talked about is, you know, it's smart to invest in women and girls. I think where I came to it was, you know, just from having an Indian background. I know there's many other Indian Americans at the conference today and in the audience, and it, you know, it's, I think everyone knows, it's common knowledge that particularly in India, you know, women's rights issues are particularly difficult. And I think ever since I was a very young child, I was lucky to be born in Canada and raised here. It always seemed to me like, why? This is a no-brainer. I mean, why is it that these things would be happening to women in India? Or it just blew my mind. And as I got older, it just didn't blow my mind. It really started to piss me off. So, you know, it was kind of that passion and that feeling that, you know, I think this is where I'm supposed to be. I think this is where I'm supposed to make a mark in the world, and just following that bliss, following that passion, using that as my compass really led me to this focus, on women and girls. So it really came from the kind of, it's the morally right thing to do, or even the just this really pisses me off point of view.
Thank you. And Yvette, Latino community, very, very close to your heart. Say more about that.
So I'm Puerto Rican. I'm Latina. I grew up, and it's not just Latino community, but really underserved communities. I grew up in poverty in northern New Jersey in the housing projects. And I was the only one, speaking about girls, I'm one of eight kids, have seven brothers, no sisters.
Oh
I was the only one to graduate from high school. Forget about go to college. I was the only one to graduate from high school. And still, I didn't think that it was because I was particularly special. I don't think, I think my career has benefited and my passions have benefited from the fact that I'm not any different from all of the girls who are still living in housing projects and who are still figuring it out and who haven't made their way yet to graduate from high school or haven't even begun to think that college is an option for them. So I wanted to make sure that in telling stories and going into communications and majoring in journalism, that I had the ability to tell the stories of people whose stories are never told. And that's poor people, usually communities of color. And having come from those communities, knowing firsthand that there's so many assets in those communities. We look at assets as wealth and homeownership and education, but there are so many assets in low-income communities. Talking about communications and social media and email, if you go into low-income communities, those are the people who are still doing it right with good old-fashioned face-to-face communication. And a lot of the skills that we praise, I think, in the corporate sector and just as professionals, like networking, they're doing it. They're just doing it with their neighbors and the people around the corner. And they know where so-and-so's kid is. And, you know, they're doing it, you know, what I think is the right way. They just haven't been able to apply those skills elsewhere, to apply those skills in the professional sector. So my passion is really being able to look and continue to look at these communities differently than I think mainstream media does, knowing that the best message and the right words are the ones that get through. So, you know, in communications and public relations, there's a lot of wordsmithing that goes on. There's people who want to say this word versus that word. And really, it's whatever gets through. Because when you're talking about access to information across, you know, low-income communities, you know, communities that are struggling, you know, you're not using the most, you know, you should stop wordsmithing, and you should stop, you know, even for those of you looking to see how can you partner with a nonprofit sector, don't make it harder than it needs to be. Don't wordsmith it. You know, just have a conversation. Have a conversation with the people at those nonprofits. Have a conversation with the communities that they serve. Because sometimes we get very impressed by the members of the board or the leadership or the conferences that they're moderating at. But get to know the communities that they serve and see if that's aligned and if that's where you want to invest your time.
Thank you for that, Yvette. And I love what you were talking about in terms of the face-to-face. You know, my personal belief is that is still the strongest means of communication. Yeah. So let me, and do you mind if I do a quick time check on your phone?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we wanted to have a couple of questions asked from the audience, but I do want to reserve 1.5 minutes before the close for one final question for all of you that we did not talk about. But do we have time for a few questions. So if folks want to approach the mics, that would be great.
Hi.
I have a question about finding nonprofits or for-profits if you know the group you want to work with. I've had a passion for working with girls in human trafficking. I have yet to find a group that's organized and credible. I'll put it that way. And so is there a national database, a local database? Where do you find these groups?
I might pitch this one to all of you. And just you're just looking for a nonprofit that focuses on that specific arena.
Either.
Thank you.
Do you mind repeating what she just the advice she gave you into the mic?
She said that there's a group in Georgia called A Future Not a Past, and she said it may be possible that they've expanded it to other. The model may be expanded to other states.
Okay, great. Thank you for sharing. Sure. Do you want to come to the mic?
There's someone over here.
And then we've got one on this side we'll start with.
Yes, I just want to provide perhaps an answer to this woman's question. The Covenant House, especially the one in New Jersey and possibly the one in Philadelphia, does have a branch of their services just for they're working with the police to try to address this issue of trafficking girls.
All right, great. Thank you.
Covenant House.
Thank you.
Okay, not a question, but a quick comment that those of you who live in Delaware or close to it, on November 5th, we are showing Girl Rising. Yes. A high school in Wilmington, Delaware, St. Mark's High School. You're all welcome to attend. And if you're interested, I can stand in the back and collect your business cards or something, and I'll send you, information on it. But it's November 5th at 7 o'clock in Wilmington, Delaware, a screening of Girl Rising.
Thank you.
Great.
No. That's why I'll stand in the back.
Go ahead, in the back.
Yeah, hi there. Anybody who wants to answer this one, Kenya, you too may have a great suggestion. I have a background in both for-profit and nonprofit, and where I find my passion is blending the two. And I wonder if you have a great piece of advice to kick off a corporate social responsibility initiative in a small company, whether through a volunteer mechanism or just a way to have our people make a difference in the communities that we do work in.
Sure, and thank you for the question. So our corporate responsibility team has been in existence since 2007, and it was kicked off by one lady. She essentially approached our CEO with a phenomenal business plan and said, this is what we need to do and why. So she had a really strong case, and he said, okay, go for it. She kind of ran solo for probably 3 years by herself. We're now a team of 16 people across the U.S. We do focus on just numerous different things, but, you know, I feel incredibly fortunate that I have that employee engagement piece and really finding ways to embed different CR initiatives into our various programs. And I think I came to this role because of my background in human resources. So when I started with the firm, I was a campus recruiter and did that for many, many years. Then moved into human resources and got to know lots and lots of people and did it for many, many years. And then it was just a really natural fit for me because even in my early days, I was very, very committed to giving back. And I just really found a lot of passion in that. And the lady that runs our corporate responsibility team, Shannon Schuyler, she and I have known each other for many, many years. And I happened to go down to Belize, Project Belize, which is one of the things I've written in my bio. And that's where she and I reconnected, and that's how I was able to join the team in this particular role. But, you know, some of the things that we really aligned ourselves with was, what are we good at? You know, we looked, okay, internally we have 40,000 people in the United States, and our people know a little bit about financial literacy. We're a professional services firm, accounting, tax, consulting. And so we really looked internally and said, that's what we're good at, and where is there a need? Well, there's a huge need from a youth education perspective. So one of our largest external commitments is what we call Earn Your Future. And it's a $160 million commitment to $60 million in cash to nonprofits that are focused on youth education, and then 1 million hours of our people's time. So I think that's really, I won't say that's how it really started, although I think Belize was a big driver for us in terms of getting involved in all that we do in the youth education space. But I think it's really looking internal at what your people are passionate about, what they're good at, what's your expertise, and then really looking for those nonprofits that can sort of help align that and help you move your strategy forward. Does that help a little bit?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything that you all want to add?
Yeah, just keeping in mind that you can either export your staff out to nonprofits for like beautification days, volunteer days, but you can also import nonprofits into your workplace. So like Big Brothers and Big Sisters locally, I know, has workplace projects where the students come to individuals' work sites. So just being creative in what works for now until you really set up a good system.
Thank you, Yvette. So how about one more? Oh, I think you were first. Let me see. Check time. Check.
Sorry.
Yep.
No problem.
Actually, we can take both of you, I think, or maybe all three of you, and then we'll move to the last question.
Good, because her question was a perfect segue to my question, actually. So if I was the nonprofit and I wanted to approach a company to either benefit from my program or donate to my program, I get storytelling is very powerful. What is the best way to engage a corporation in your nonprofit initiative?
I'm going to say get to know what that corporation's philanthropic interests are. So many companies have foundations if they're larger companies, but even for smaller companies, they usually communicate some type of community commitment on their websites. So for some, it's education. For some, it's financial literacy. So first and foremost, make sure that you're well-aligned with whatever they've already communicated as the issues that they are looking to invest in. And then I think it's, you know, networking is cliche, but getting to know who within that company is responsible for that, whether they actually have a corporate responsibility team or they have someone in the community affairs, even public relations, if they don't have the others, to see where there might be some alignment in your nonprofit's mission and the work that they're trying to do.
And is there a website like the ones you mentioned earlier that have some kind of directory of corporations and their philanthropic interests? Yes, there is. Idealist.org, she's telling me. What about the corporations, though? If they have a foundation. Okay,
I also think to piggyback off of Samantha's idea earlier is stay local. So before you even need to look into a national database, who are the major corporations in your region or in your city or in your town? Because they're usually most invested within the reach of where their employees live and work.
And I'm just going to add, it also depends on how much you need. Like, are you talking $5 million or you're talking $5,000? Sometimes it takes longer to go to PepsiCo and ask them to give you money than it does to a small to medium-sized business who's psyched about what you do. And then I can't echo enough, as much as all the research about corporate alignment, et cetera, when they connect with you as a person and your passion, money opens up. It's amazing. Like, there's nothing more powerful than people believing in you. And like all things, it's that face-to-face, it's that human connection, and nothing's more powerful than that in bringing in funding for a nonprofit.
Thank you.
Sure.
And my question is pretty much the same. We're a small nonprofit organization with a small board. I wanted to find out if there were ways that we could connect with local individuals that maybe have certain skills that we would need, whether it's public relations and things like that, accounting, that we could tap into to find out how we can get those people interested in our work. And maybe there's even a place that is listed where people are looking for certain organizations or types of missions on certain organizations that they would be interested in. And my particular area would be violence you know, supporting families who've been affected by violence.
So I know that locally, LaSalle has the LaSalle Nonprofit Center, and they train and work with corporate employees to sit on nonprofit boards, so that's a great resource. I believe the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce also has a committee or an effort to be able to get people from the business sector involved in nonprofit and or arts and culture boards. So those are more formal ways. I think informally, who does your board know and who does your staff know?
That's how we usually do it.
Within companies in the region. And you don't always have to aim for the CEO who is overly committed or someone on the executive team who is overly committed. There might be people, you know, with no formal executive title within the company, but who has a passion for what you do. And being able to first communicate that that's what you're looking for and let it go from there.
Thank you. LaSalle is right in my area, so thank you very much.
Yep.
Last one. Hi, my name is Fatu. Samantha, good to see you again. And I don't serve in boards or even employer because I'm still in college, but I was interested in this session. So I just want maybe like quickly if you could say like one advice you could have for a passionate, very curious college young girl or guy when it comes to social entrepreneurship.
I like that. One nugget from everybody.
Yeah, fantastic. Great question. Get out there and try lots of different things. Be willing, if you can, to work for free or have a day job and or night job and, you know, get your foot in the door with an organization and make yourself indispensable to them, because having run a nonprofit for many years, we get calls, do you have a job opening? No, we never have job openings. But if an intern, this happened to us recently, if an intern comes in and works for free for 6 months and they make themselves so indispensable, they just outshine everyone else, we will find the money. We will find the money to keep them on staff. So, you know, even if a job isn't open, don't let that put you off. But, you know, you need to be willing to get in there and make an investment.
That's my nugget. My nugget, and it goes for some of the questions about finding volunteers, and it definitely goes to the question about how to get your foot in the door, how to succeed in social entrepreneurship. Just one thing, and that's persistence. I say that because I am flooded with emails all the time. Can I volunteer with you? Can I? I'm a seasoned executive. I would like to give you our time for free. Like, it sounds great, but you have a full inbox and no time. And I really have this folder in my inbox. It's like action needed sometime. And it's only getting bigger. And the people that I get back to, it's not because I don't want to get back to them, are people who literally email me 4 or 5 times. Like, just like, sorry to be annoying. I'm emailing again. Sorry to be annoying. And I don't find it annoying. It's like, thanks. I forgot it. Thanks. And I email them back. And I find that we all feel so timid to be annoying that we only ask once and nervously. But I would say my advice to you is don't feel shy. Just keep asking until you get it. You want someone to volunteer, ask them a lot of times. Eventually, if they say no, they'll be like, but I know somebody. Yes. Or you're like, I really want to work for you. I really want to intern. And eventually, they'll say no, but like, they'll may suggest where to go. So I would just say, don't take no for an answer and be as persistent and to the point of being annoying and to the point where they ask you to stop calling them, and you'll do well.
I love that. I think find a passion mentor. Whatever it is that you're passionate about, get to know that field more or ask around and find a woman or a man, but a woman for today's purposes. We have many amazing women leaders. Find a woman who is equally passionate and use her as a guide for how you grow your career or your passion until they align to be the same thing. The other thing I would say is, whether in the midst of my brothers or in the midst of executive teams where I was the only woman at the table, the word humble doesn't come up when you're in a room of men. I think as women, we often say, I'm so humbled by the opportunity, and I'm so humbled, you know, by you calling me back. Walk into the room or walk into the opportunity with some arrogance. You know, the fact that you have already showcased that you have an interest in X shows a lot of leadership and shows a lot of guts. And pursuing that opportunity will eventually yield great results.
You know, I love that last point, and this is something interesting that I just read. Have you, any of you read Give and Take, Adam Grant book? Yeah, great book. I recommend it. But there's a story in there about the difference between men and women and how men will negotiate for raises, obviously much more than women. But if a woman approaches negotiating a raise, and this situation could be translated into many different situations, but the story is that if women were to negotiate a salary increase for themselves, pretending they were negotiating it for someone else other than for themselves, the likelihood that they'll get that increase is exponentially higher. It's just an interesting phenomenon, interesting to think about. And I promise one last surprise question. Loved Candy Chang this morning. Before I die, All right, I'll start while y'all think. I just love that. I love that board. So I was thinking about this after, as I was watching her this morning, and I thought, love my job, love PwC, love everything that I do. Eventually, I will retire. And when I retire, what I want to do is coach. So I'm pursuing my coaching certifications, and I'm almost there. But what I, the niche market that I want to coach around is underserved, minority, first-generation college students, and I want to coach them to get through college within a reasonable amount of time. Thank you. Thank you. And you know what they say about goals? Be specific. So I'm gonna get 500, at least 500 through in the next 10 years.
So before I die, I want to win a Pulitzer for one of the many books that I will publish that will tell the stories and or inspire young girls who grew up in neighborhoods like mine and know that their world is unlimited.
I'm going to go small, but I think powerful. Before I die, I want to raise my two boys to be God's gift to women in a good way.
I totally missed the talk, so your question threw me. And the first thing that came to mind was, before I die, I will high-five Obama.
That's good. You can write, you can say that. You can say it. All right. I love it. You... You've all been phenomenal, and this is a great conference. I feel very privileged to be here.